election that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, today we were supposed to have had a special guest this evening, Steve Quayle. We were going to talk about all the microbiologists who have been killed recently. There are well over 100 of them. These are men who are eminent microbiologists, and over 100 of them have died very, very strange deaths, as if perhaps they were involved in some sort of activity, perhaps some experimentation. They knew too much, that old adage, the man who knew too much. Well, they've been killed. I remember reading about one of them who supposedly just drove his car out to the middle of a bridge and just jumped off into the water. Another one was found with multiple stab wounds stuffed into the trunk of his car. I think they call that a suicide, but time and again we see these same patterns over and over again. And the question is why. However, our special guest is not going to be with us. We haven't been able to reach him. And so, we're going to really tell you a story. And if you want to call in, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I really would want you to hold your calls for a few minutes. And if you call in on the general subject we're going to be talking about, because we're going to be talking about one of the most incredible things that's gone on during the last 25 years, and yet most people are totally unaware of it. Well, it was last Saturday. I was finishing up my June newsletter, and for those of you who subscribe to our newsletter, you haven't gotten it yet, but I want you to know that it's done, and we'll have it out probably, hopefully, within a relatively few days. I was finishing up my newsletter when the manager and the owner of the local radio station called me. And, of course, as I live here in the Monterey Bay area, and the manager of the radio station and I are on fairly good terms. I've been on a number of times on programs there. He told me he was going to have a couple of people on talking about the AIDS epidemic. And one was a woman who had been misdiagnosed as having HIV disease. The other was a man who'd been to Africa and knew all about the African AIDS epidemic, and he wondered if I would like to call in and perhaps ask some questions. Well, I really wasn't that interested in calling in. I had lots of things to do, but I decided, well, at least I'll listen to the program and see what's happening. And so I started listening. Well, now the gentleman had a Ph.D., wasn't a medical doctor, but he had been over in Africa for some purpose, and he was talking about the AIDS epidemic in Africa. He was pointing out that the World Health Organization has determined that you diagnose AIDS in Africa by the fact that people have a temperature, they have a cough, they have a weight loss, they have diarrhea, and if you had all of those four things, you had AIDS. In other words, they don't have the medical facilities to do the extensive testing, the blood testing, to follow the CD4 count, to do the ELISA, the Western blot, the viral loads that we do here in America. But the World Health Organization used that criterion that we've just given you to make the diagnosis of AIDS. And the gentleman's point was, this is ridiculous. The woman, on the other hand, was pointing out that the ELISA test, which is a routine screening test, is not diagnostic of AIDS, that you can't make the diagnosis with a viral load or with the CD4 count, which is the helper, the lymphocytes that are ordinarily low in this disease. In fact, she made out the point that you really have no means of actually making the diagnosis of AIDS, and of course these tests are unreliable. And the basic underlying theme of what she was saying is, maybe we shouldn't be testing at all. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and basically, as I'm listening to this program, and I'm hearing the doctor, the PhD doctor, saying that there is no epidemic in Africa, and I should point out that everything he says is absolutely accurate. The World Health Organization criteria for diagnosing AIDS in Africa is totally ridiculous. However, there are many hospitals in Africa, and there are many well-trained physicians, I practice medicine in South Africa. They had very high standards. They do widespread testing for HIV, and certainly in South Africa, in Kenya, and in many of the countries there that do have good medical facilities. They know how to make the diagnosis, and I've talked to doctors from Kenya, who told me, of course, they know when the people have AIDS. It's an entirely different type of disease than the tuberculosis or the malaria, the multiple other diseases that plague the tragic people of Africa. And so a trained physician knows whether this is AIDS or not. And so many people are dying there they have difficulty coming up with enough coffins to put all the bodies in. One of the greatest human tragedies of all time is unfolding in Africa today, and certainly in Botswana, which is a very wealthy country. It's probably, as far as the black nations, it is by far the most wealthy country. They have an excellent medical care there. In fact, because they have extensive holdings of diamonds and mining, they have extensive copper and nickel mines there and other metals. Botswana has able to finance a very, very high quality of health care, so that they do something that has only been done here in the United States recently, and that is they do routine HIV or AIDS testing on every pregnant woman who comes in for her prenatal care. And they find that in Botswana today, 46% of the women who come in to for their prenatal testing, 46% of the women are HIV positive. They're all going to die. Now, that's almost half of the women in Botswana are HIV infected. This is a terrible human tragedy that's unfolding there. And yet, of course, so this gentleman on the radio is saying, in essence, there is no AIDS epidemic in Africa, and he's following a line that is being put out all across America by a small group of people who have tried to change the framework of what the discussion is, and away from where did the disease come from and why aren't we trying to stop it, to is there an epidemic? Is there an epidemic at all? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just, of course, discussing this radio program that I participated in this last Saturday. The gentleman who had been in Africa pointed out the absurdity of the World Health Organization criterion for making the diagnosis of AIDS, and their criteria was weight loss, fever, diarrhea, and a cough, and if you had all those four things, you had AIDS, and that, of course, is totally ridiculous. And I'm sure that in many of the countries there, at least where they have the adequate medical facilities, why they can separate, whether this is AIDS or some other disease, because AIDS is really a very specific disease. It is characterized specifically by a fall in the CD4 count. In other words, the CD4 cells are the helper lymphocytes, and the helper lymphocytes help you fight infection. So if they fall too low, they fall below about 200, then you become susceptible to all sorts of disease. And here in America, why they get avian tuberculosis, the sort of tuberculosis that birds would get. You and I come in contact with that every day, but we're immune to it. People with an altered immune system are susceptible to it, but in Africa, of course, susceptible to regular tuberculosis. And if they have malaria, and of course, millions, and well, it's estimated between 300 and 500 million people contract malaria somewhere in the world every year. And if you get that, and of course you have an altered immune system, as the patients with in Africa do, why? Well, they become much more susceptible to that disease. So, I mean, certainly either, but a good doctor can tell whether they've got malaria or whether they've got tuberculosis or whether they've got one of the diarrheas that are so prevalent in Africa or whether they have an altered immune system, which is so characteristic of AIDS. Well, the general theme of the program, this radio program I was asked to listen to, was, first of all, there is no AIDS epidemic in Africa. And then, of course, the woman who was speaking, I think her name was Kathleen or Catherine, And she was saying we shouldn't be doing any testing because, after all, she had been misdiagnosed with HIV. She really didn't have it. And of course, the HIV test wasn't any good, and the CD4 count wasn't adequate to make the diagnosis, and the viral load wasn't accurate. And so we really shouldn't be, of course, bothering to test because none of the tests were accurate. And furthermore, many of the medications that were being used were toxic. And this was really sort of a conspiracy upon the part of the drug companies to sell a lot of very expensive drugs. And many of these drugs are very toxic. And many of these drugs can actually simulate many of the symptoms of HIV, and especially in the terminal stage with a neuropathy. And certainly that is true of certainly of the medications that are out there. And there was a lot of truth in what both of them were saying. The only trouble was that they were confusing the issue. There is a massive AIDS epidemic in Africa, and there is an epidemic here in the United States. Now, by drawing attention to what's going on in Africa, they can ignore the fact we've lost 500,000 people. Over 500,000 people have died here in the United States of AIDS, or the terminal stage of HIV disease. Another million or more infected in the United States. Throughout the world, 25 to 30 million people have died by World Health Organization statistics, and those are statistics actually which are collected by certain private organizations, but they're probably fairly accurate. And another 50 million people are infected throughout the world, and most of them are going to progress to death. So what they're doing is confusing the issue, and it was really very, very clever because much of what they said was accurate. But, of course, what they're doing is arguing the wrong issue. They're talking about AIDS in Africa. They should be talking about AIDS here in the United States, where we know a great deal about the disease. We know it's primarily a disease of blacks. And about 55% of all new AIDS cases in the United States are in blacks. And this disease has a predilection for blacks in the United States. And this is why, of course, it has a predilection for blacks in Africa, and why we see such a high incidence of the disease, much higher in Africa than we see in the United States. And of course, I can remember when we were first involved with the AIDS epidemic, and we saw the very high rate in the homosexuals, and we saw it doubling, you know, and increasing at such a rapid rate initially, and we were sure it was going to spread into the heterosexual population from the homosexual population. And it did not spread. In other words, up to 75% of the homosexuals in San Francisco, and we could chart them because they'd all been taken part, in other words, a certain number of homosexuals there, had taken part in an experimental hepatitis B vaccine studies. So they had their blood specimens, which had been kept on file. And when HIV came along, why, then they retested those blood specimens which were on file for this hepatitis B study, and you could just see this epidemic exploding in the homosexuals up to the point where 75% of the homosexuals in the hepatitis B study, an experimental vaccine that was given to see whether it worked, 75% of them had contracted the disease by about 1987, somewhere in there, 1987, 1988. And, I mean, these were just disastrous figures. And, of course, I'll have to admit that when I was first beginning to study this, I could not imagine in my mind at all, in my worst nightmares, that maybe the reason that 75% of the homosexuals in that hepatitis B experimental study, experimental hepatitis B vaccine, the reason that 75% of the homosexuals had the disease was because the infection was in the experimental vaccine that they took. I couldn't believe that, but because I didn't want to get into that discussion, because I wanted, and I did call in on the radio program, and I certainly pointed out that they were arguing the wrong issue. They were arguing whether the epidemic existed at all, and they were talking about Africa, where they do not have as accurate statistics as they have here in the United States or in Europe or even in Russia. They have fairly accurate statistics, and there about 2% of the population are HIV infected, and it's having a disastrous effect on the population. And here in the United States, we have very accurate statistics overall. And as far as, of course, questioning the blood tests, well, of course, initially that simply mentioned the initial ELISA test, they hadn't mentioned the Western blot. So let me explain to you how you make the diagnosis. First of all, you do a general screening test. It's known as an ELISA test. It's an antibody test, and it is a very, very sensitive test, and actually it will pick up other conditions. You can have other infections, and it will register positive. So one ELISA test, if it's positive, doesn't necessarily mean you have AIDS or you have HIV infected. In fact, now they can even do it with simply a cotton swab in your mouth, something known as the OraSure test. It is a screening test. And if that is positive on several occasions, and they can determine if it's positive now in about 20 minutes, then you would take a Western blot, which is a very specific test for the fragments of the virus which are in the circulation. And then, of course, if you really wanted to be sure, although this is not ordinarily done, because if you have a couple of positive ELISA tests and a couple of positive Western blot tests, I mean, you're 99.9% certain to have HIV disease. You actually can culture the virus, as they have done in the military, to be absolutely certain. This is not ordinarily done in clinical practice. You will very, 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 very rarely get a false positive test now. It certainly can happen, but then, of course, you could have a false positive at a biopsy for cancer. You could have a false positive at a test for diabetes. You could have all sorts of false positives, and you can't just stop doing testing because you might very, 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 very rarely get a false positive. And yet that was the general tone of what I was hearing. We shouldn't be testing for the disease. It is the toxic medicines that are creating the disease, and there really is no epidemic in Africa. And, you know, by carrying that over, logically, there is no epidemic in America. And this is part of a planned program. These people have gone all over the United States. I've heard them at medical meetings. And ordinarily, of course, they'll get up, they'll make their point, and then they'll refuse to debate the issue. The gentleman who really originated this idea was a Dr. Duesberg. And Dr. Duesberg was part of an initial experimentation financed by the CIA. It was called the Special Viral Cancer Project. And Dr. Duesberg was part of this. They were creating new diseases for the Central Intelligence Agency. And Dr. Duesberg is now out saying there is no AIDS epidemic. He's written a book called The Myth of AIDS. And of course, there is a small number of people who go all over the country confusing people about what is really going on. And they have basically framed the argument, not, you know, where did the disease come from and why aren't we doing what's logical to try to stop its spread? They reframed that into, is there really an epidemic? Well, of course, as you begin to analyze this, it's really very, very shrewd, because there's an organized effort to give us so much information we really can't think clearly about what's going on. Now, Dr. Duesberg in the past has refused to debate me on this subject. We had one debate. Subsequently, when he's been on programs that I've called in, he's threatened to leave the program if I stayed on, because I was one of the few people who was able actually to counter his ridiculous arguments. He did have a associate named Brian Ellison, who went across the country and appeared on many conservative radio programs claiming that I was a CIA-paid individual. I was being paid as a CIA to put out the false information that there actually was an AIDS epidemic. In fact, one of the most clever things they did was actually to go to my good friend, Congressman Dannemeyer, and Congressman Bill Dannemeyer, and they kept calling him every day and saying, well, would there be anything wrong with certainly going ahead and analyzing to see if Dr. Duesberg might be right that there is no AIDS epidemic? And call after call after call, he finally said, well, there's nothing wrong with it, at least looking into it. They got him to write a letter, and suddenly all over America they were saying, even Congressman Dannemeyer realizes there is no AIDS epidemic. You know, here, look at this letter he's written saying we should have congressional hearings to find out if there's any, really is an AIDS epidemic. And they so confused the minds of the American people that we've allowed 500,000 Americans to die in this country unnecessarily. We stopped the SARS epidemic throughout the world very easily by using standard public health techniques. We have never used standard public health techniques to stop the AIDS epidemic. And we'll be back in just a few minutes and welcome your calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and since our regular guest isn't here, why, we're just going to have a monologue, but we'll be glad to take your calls on this subject at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, people still go around, of course, putting out this idea that there is no AIDS epidemic, that AIDS is really caused by the medications that people are taking, and you would think that, well, certainly most doctors would scoff at this, but it really doesn't matter whether the doctors scoff at it or not. If you can reach the people and you can get the people confused, you will win the debate as far as the general thrust of things are going, and there's nobody out there who's really debating this issue. And certainly, these people always say they would love to have a debate, but when it gets right down to it, why they usually run for cover, if you can point out the fallacies of what they're saying. And the major problem that we face today is the fact that we have not done what was proper from a public health point of view to stop this epidemic. Now, how do you stop an epidemic? Why, you find out who has the disease, and then you try to stop them from giving it to other people. That would be the logical thing. We did that with other sexually transmitted diseases. We did that with syphilis for many years, and we had routine testing in doctor's offices. And when I went into medicine, certainly it was routine. Every time a patient went in the hospital, they got tested for syphilis. We wanted to find out who had syphilis so we could stop them from giving it to others. And then, of course, we had premarital testing, because this is a sexually transmitted disease, and people who have it, get married, do have intimate relations, and that's how you would spread it to others. And then, of course, we had prenatal testing. In other words, if a woman was pregnant, you didn't want her child to have congenital syphilis, so you tested mothers, and, of course, there were treatments that were quite effective for syphilis, so it would not be spread from the mother to her child. And we have treatments that are very effective as far as HIV. But by not doing routine HIV testing, we allowed the disease to spread from the infected mother to their children, and we killed thousands of innocent children here in America because there was an organized effort to block any effort to do what was logical to stop this disease. You would certainly, as far as the drug users were concerned, initially what they would do is tell the drug users, just go out and use your drugs, but use a little bleach here to, 10% bleach solution to wash out your syringe and your needles, and knowing full well that a 10% bleach solution would not kill the virus. And as a result of that public health program, and the public health program involves dispensing 10% bleach. Now, you would think in a country that can put a man on the moon and send probes to Mars, somebody might have checked in, just with a little 10% bleach and see if it would kill the virus. And it took them many years to find out it didn't kill the virus. You have to have 100% bleach, full-strength bleach to actually kill the virus. But we didn't do any of the things that were logical to stop the epidemic. And as a direct result of that, 500,000 people in the United States and 20 to 30 million people throughout the world have died of this unnecessary epidemic. And the average person has no idea what's going on because they get so confused. And then they'll hear a program like the one we heard on Saturday by people who say there is no epidemic. The blood tests that the doctors use are not accurate. And the real reason that they have the epidemic is so people can make a lot of money. And we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I simply made the point, and we'll get to our caller in just a moment, and I'll put out our telephone number once more. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we could have stopped the AIDS epidemic beginning back in 1983 and 1984 when they had an effective blood test had we started doing routine testing on patients coming into doctor's offices. We could have had every patient going into the dentist have a routine test. We could have done premarital testing and prenatal testing. You would identify the people who had this disease and try to stop them from spreading the disease. We did not do any of the logical things. Are they logical? Of course. I went to the CDC and back in, I think it was 1988, 1989, and actually talked to Jim Curran, who was in charge of the AIDS division there at the CDC, and I asked him why they weren't doing what was logical. And he said, Jim Curran looked me in the eye and he said, you know, I'm in charge of this. I'm caught in between Congressman Waxman on one side, doesn't want to do anything, and Congressman Dannemeyer and Lorraine Day on the other side, and they want to treat this effectively. What am I supposed to do? I said, you ought to do what was right. And so he did what was right. He resigned and quit and went to work at Emory University. But the great tragedy is we've lost 500,000 people in America because every effort to treat this disease effectively and do what was right has been blocked. Only recently, 26 years into the epidemic now, 25 years into the epidemic, has the CDC suddenly come forward and said, yes, we should start doing routine testing. That was what we were recommending back in 1987 at the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association, and eventually, of course, after 10 years, the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association accepted the programs that I laid out, and I really didn't come up with them. They were put together by the doctors in my community. A group of them got together and said, this is what we need. And remember, I'm an orthopedist. I don't know all these things, but they did. We had an effective program. Had it been adopted in 1987, it would have stopped the epidemic. We were blocked at every turn. In 1994, 1995, the doctors of the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association finally accepted my position. I got a standing ovation on the floor of the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association. I thought we'd won the battle. But I didn't understand. Because the leaders of the House of Delegates, the administration, refused to carry out the dictates of the doctors, just like they do back in Washington, D.C. The congressmen vote one way, but none of these things ever get implemented. And I suddenly realized that we were simply all pawns in this game. And millions of people were going to die, and that's why I dropped out of the California Medical Association, and I dropped out of the practice of medicine, and I began doing talk radio, and of course I've learned so much since then. Not only about AIDS, but about this whole population control agenda. Because, ladies and gentlemen, there is a population control agenda. And AIDS did not occur in chimpanzees. In fact, until recently, the only chimpanzees that were infected with HIV disease were laboratory chimpanzees. And some of those were actually released subsequently in the wild. And now they found it in the wild chimpanzees, but never before did they find it in wild chimpanzees. It was always found in laboratory. Why do you think it was only found, HIV was only found in laboratory chimpanzees? Is it possible that this is an experimental virus intentionally created with a predilection for blacks, designed to kill off millions of people throughout the world? Well, we'll get back to that subject in just a moment. Right now we have Ray on the line calling from Santa Cruz. So, hi, Ray. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I do. I wondered if you had called the black men that were infected with syphilis in an experiment, and the Army had an experiment back in the early 50s, I think it was, and they were infected with syphilis and...
That was the Tuskegee study, and it was carried out from 1931 to 1971. Right.
What I'm wondering is, the military seems to be popping up in my head all the time when I think about things like this, and I'm trying to draw a connection between that and Operation Paperclip and all that other stuff. You know, there's like a trail of individuals involved in this population control thing, and I would have to say that I believe that they deliberately infected these men. I think they're really trying to kill off black people, is what I think.
Well, basically, these people are already infected.
Yeah.
It was simply that they, when they had treatment for it, they withheld it intentionally because they wanted them to die. That was the purpose of it. We have a great four tapes out on the Tuskegee study with the interviews of the people who really have all of the information on it. James Jones, who wrote the class book on it, certainly the interview with a man who broke the story and stopped the Tuskegee study, who was a lawyer up in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it's a fascinating four tape set. No, they didn't infect the people. They just kept them from getting treatment because they wanted them to die.
Oh,
and nobody was ever held responsible. We'll be. But thanks so much for calling me.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly we're talking, right now we have a, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So give us a call if you have a question or comment. But right now, of course, we've got Dan calling from Houston with a question. So let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do, Dr. Stan. I really appreciate your program, and I heard Dr. Scott the other night also. I'm confused as to whether we're actually testing for a specific viral particle that we can isolate, or is it some binary mycoplasma with maybe a Vishna sheep virus or a Brucella abortus without a wall like a mycoplasma. I'm concerned because the people that I've heard say that AIDS is contrived, it will state, have we ever really isolated a virus, HIV virus?
They're trying to confuse you. Yes, they have isolated the HIV virus. They can grow this in culture. It's very lethal. And if you read, of course, the book that's written by Dr. Duesberg, he will tell you, look, I mean, why would you say that this, you know, is a dangerous virus? You grow it in white cells. Well, you know, I didn't know how to answer that, so I talked to the chief of virology at the Centers for Disease Control, and he said, sure, you grow the HIV virus in white cells, and it kills the white cells. You have to keep adding more and more and more white cells. The other alternative is you use cancerous white cells from B-cell leukemia patients, and they, of course, these cells will not die, so you can't kill them with HIV. But yes, they have isolated the virus. But but the other thing is, of course, that Dr. Don Scott mentioned the other night, and which, of course, if you read the book by Dr. Nicholson entitled Project Daylily, and of course you get into Len Horowitz's book, Emerging Viruses. There is a co-infection. Now, this was first hypothesized by Luc Montagnier, and that is that it was not only HIV, but there was a mycoplasma along with it. This is not just any run-of-the-mill mycoplasma, however. This is a genetically altered mycoplasma for which the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology has the patent. Why does the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology have the patent? Because they created this variation. In fact, the HIV virus, it has one of the molecules from this genetically altered mycoplasm on its shell. So they have actually created these cellular modifications, and this is a man-created disease. It is two things together. If you don't have the HIV, you have chronic fatigue, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dan was calling from Houston and asking, whether or not they'd actually ever isolated the virus. And the thing is, they can grow the virus. They grow it in white cells. So the people who say there is no HIV virus are simply deceiving you. But where most doctors are confused, and there's been an organized effort to confuse the general population, is it is a dual infection. It is not simply HIV. It is HIV, and at least 90% of the people will have a mycoplasma infection that they can identify going along with that. So, and this was originally hypothesized by Luc Montagnier at the Pasteur Institute over in Paris. Of course, Robert Gallo, who is part and parcel of the problem here in the United States, suggested it was a herpes 6 virus, but I think Dr. Gallo, having worked with all of these scientists who are working with the CIA, I'm sure knew a lot more about this disease than the average virologist did. And I think he's done everything he could to throw us off the track. AIDS itself is HIV plus mycoplasm. And that is why it's so deadly. And it just destroys the immune system. There's no immune response. And we actually have the complete testimony that was given back in 1969, whether it was June or July, by Dr. Donald MacArthur. And we actually can provide you one or two pages of that. Or if you want to read the entire thing, of course, we'd have to charge you for it. But we have the testimony before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969, where Dr. MacArthur went before the congressman there and asked for $10 million to create an entirely new disease that had never existed before, for which there would be no immune response. And then he went on to say, some people think we should not do this because it would be another means of mass killing, but we want the money and we want to produce it. And of course, it was 10 years later. He said it would take 10 years. 10 years later, why, the first AIDS cases appeared in San Francisco. They didn't recognize it because that was 1979. And of course, they were predominantly in homosexuals who'd taken an experimental hepatitis B vaccine. The first cases were actually described in 1981.
Well, would there be a test on your blood, a serology test like complement fixation or gluten test to test for mycoplasma concomitantly with that?
So well, you have to have very, very special tests done for that, very special PCR tests to actually identify the mycoplasm. There are blood tests, but the average laboratory is not going to be able to run them for you.
Well, the other question I had is, will tears in your eyes, tears and secretion, sweat, and things like that transmit the virus?
There are instances where it has, yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Stan. Thanks a lot.
God bless. Okay. Well, again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And let's go to Steve, who's calling from Albany. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I haven't talked in a few months. Nice to hear from you. Can I ask you something? Now, you're talking about AIDS, and I was told recently, I had been going to the hospital a lot lately. I've had some problems. And I caught MRSA. Do you know what MRSA is?
No, I really don't.
Oh, it's a... I was just wondering if is that as dangerous as AIDS?
I really don't know what MRSA is. Maybe somebody could call in and tell us.
Okay, it's some kind of, you know, bug you catch in the hospital, and they tell me they have no antibiotics that can, you know, cure it right now. And I was just wondering if you're not, some type of, you know, nasty bug.
It must be some sort of an antibiotic-resistant organism.
Yes.
Is it a streptococcus?
Excuse me?
Is it a streptococcus or is it a staphylococcus or what is it?
Yes, my friend says the first one.
All right.
And the doctors and the nurses have to wear these paper gowns when they're coming towards me, you know, and then I have to have a private room, and it's really...
Do you have sores on your body, or where is...
No, I don't have any sores. I think I caught it when they, you know, had an operation, and, you know, they did a little swab on where my operation was done, and they found, you know, the MRSA there. And I'm trying to get, Fox News was talking about it today. And
I'm afraid I don't know well, but if we perhaps somebody can call in and bring us up to date on that. You know, I don't practice in the hospitals anymore. I spend more of my time trying to educate people about the big picture, and that is that there really, of course, is a population control agenda.
Right.
They're killing hundreds of millions of people.
Can I ask you, are you familiar with Plum Island?
Yes, uh-huh.
Because I used to live on Long Island.
All right,
I was just wondering... You know, living on Long Island, and Plum Island is right off the island.
No, Plum Island is on a separate little island there, and well, they have a laboratory. I think it's called 257. It was basically where they were creating these new diseases. And of course, Plum Island is just across the inlet from a place called Lyme, Connecticut, where the first cases of Lyme disease came from. And there's a book titled Lab 257 that goes into the whole background of the bizarre experiments that the government was doing to create new chronic diseases to incapacitate the people.
You said it's a book? There's a book out?
Yes, it's called Lab 257, as I remember. And I don't know whether we have it. We carried it for a long time. There wasn't that much demand for it, so I don't think we have any more. But it's Lab 257, as I remember, is the title of the book.
Okay, maybe I can get it off eBay or something.
Okay, fine. But you have to understand that basically, if you go back and you read Brzezinski's book, Zygmunt Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages. Now, remember I talked about Dr. MacArthur testimony? It was June or July of 1969, but as I remember, it was 1970 when Zygmunt Brzezinski's book came out the following year, Between Two Ages, and there he talks, you know, and there's a notation at the bottom of one of the pages about somebody that he is using as an authority, saying, you know, certainly by the year 2018, we will be able to create storms and droughts. and create new chronic diseases to disable the populations, so we won't have to defeat them, you know, militarily. We just go in and take over the country because there'd be no resistance. So our government began working on these, mm-hmm. you know, new diseases to use on the enemy. And, of course, we are considered the enemy. They've unleashed them on the American people.
Oh, my God.
And if you
God.
Haven't read the book, it's entitled Project Daylily, written by our good friend Dr. Garth Nicholson, one of the world's leading scientists. And I checked him out before I ever had him on our programs. And, you know, I talked to his students. I talked to other physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this book about, of course, what happened to him when he discovered how they'd unleashed this at a place called Huntsville, Texas, on the prisoners there. And, of course, they infected the prisoners, and then the prisoners infected the guards, and the guards infected their families. They had epidemics of multiple sclerosis and Lou Gehrig's disease and this little tiny town, and everything was cover-up. We can't let the American people know what we've done.
We got to do something. We got to spread the word.
That's all right, and that's why we do what we do.
Spread the gospel. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
And let me suggest, if you have not seen my DVD or VHS called Plant Population Reduction, it's actually available through the Prophecy Club, or we actually have it, and it gives you a lot the overview. It gives you the background of why they outlawed DDT. It wasn't because it wasn't effective or because it was dangerous. It was too effective. It was saving too many lives. And, of course, Alexander King, the co-chairman of the Club of Rome, said, you know, we've got to do away with DDT. We can't have this. It's not because it doesn't work, but it's saving so many lives. People are not dying of malaria, and there are too many people in the world. And that's why they outlawed DDT.
Really?
100 million people have died of that since they outlawed it back in 1973, almost 100 million. And we never talk about that here in America. And now suddenly they're saying, well, you know, maybe it really doesn't do any harm. Maybe certainly in Mozambique and some of those tropical countries, why it's all right to spray the rooms, because it cuts down dramatically on the incidence of malaria in people. And now after 33 years, we're suddenly saying it's all right to go ahead and use it. 100 million people are dead, but that's all right. We made a little mistake. I don't think they made a mistake at all. If you look and see what's happening in Africa, why, their population growth has fallen dramatically. In many of the countries, for instance, and I forgot whether it's Tanzania or Zambia or Rhodesia, the lifespan has fallen from about 60 down to about 35 for the average male. You see, they have a very, very effective genocidal policy, but they can't let the American people know that. They can't let the American people know that there really are people who want to kill off the majority of the population. And if you doubt that, you need only to go to Elberton, Georgia, to see the Georgia Guidestones. There's a cult monument there, just a little south and to the north of Elberton.
What about them on the internet?
Right. And, of course, there they talk about, you know, how we've got to get the world population, maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature, which doesn't sound too bad. Unless, of course, you understand they're talking about eliminating over 90% of the world's population.
Unbelievable.
There really are people who have this mentality.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, you only need to read what Jacques Cousteau said in the November 1991 issue of UNESCO Courier. And for the skeptic out there, we'll be glad to send you copy of that publication. That's November 1991 UNESCO Courier. And you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And just ask for the Jacques Cousteau material. He advocates killing 300, or eliminating, I guess he didn't want to kill him, he just wanted to eliminate 365,000 people a day.
Oh.
365,000 people a day. And where is the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal condemning this this subhuman individual? Anybody who would advocate that, you know, has lost all contact with the human race. And yet, of course, he's lauded and applauded by a liberal publication, Jacques Cousteau.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unbelievable. Well, thank you, Dr. Stan, for enlightening us.
Okay, God bless. Thanks so much.
Okay, Steve. I'll call you next month. Bye.
Okay. Well, that was Steve calling from Albany, New York. And, again, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, we were telling you about this radio program, and I was asked to call in on, so I'll have to admit, I stopped doing my newsletter, and I called in, and I simply pointed out that much of what they said was absolutely true. The World Health Organization definition of AIDS in Africa, that people had AIDS if they had a cough and a fever and cholera and they were losing weight, but I said diarrhea, and losing weight was absolutely ridiculous. But I believed it was designed to be ridiculous, to confuse people about the extent of this epidemic, and that we should not be talking about AIDS in Africa, where our statistics are nowhere near as good as they are in the United States. Why did we talk about the incidence of the disease in America, where it is primarily a disease of blacks? Well, immediately I was attacked then for saying this was a disease of blacks. And this gentleman who was on there said, why, you know, this is not a disease of blacks. In fact, in San Francisco, you know, here five years ago, we had 20 people with AIDS. And the next year, we had 15 people with AIDS. And the next year, we had 10 people with AIDS. And last year, there was only one black person with AIDS. This is not a disease of blacks. And I said, well, the CDC statistics, incidentally, I get these. I have going back for 20 years. I come once a year, and I'm on the mailing list. They send them to me regularly. Not only that, but we have the statistics out of Africa. And, of course, what we were able then to determine was the fact that... Anyway, what we were able to... actually to determine, oh, was that, I'm going to just have to take just a moment here and get some music, and I'll be right back here at Radio Learn. Dr. Stan, and somebody had called about Dr. MacArthur, wanted to know about his remarks, and of course what Dr. MacArthur had said. Let me just read to you what Dr. MacArthur had said. This is his testimony. There are two things about biological agent field I'd like to mention. One is the possibility of technological surprise. Molecular biology is a field that is advancing very rapidly, and eminent biologists believe that within a period of 5 to 10 years, it would be possible to produce a synthetic biological agent, an agent that does not naturally exist, and for which no natural immunity could have been acquired. And Mr. Sykes, was the congressman, said, are we doing any work in that field? And Dr. MacArthur replied, we're not. And Mr. Sykes said, well, why not? Lack of money or lack of interest. And MacArthur said... And then he went on to say, would you provide for our records information on what would be required and what the advantages of such a program would be, the time that would and the cost involved? And Dr. MacArthur said they'd be very happy. And then, of course, he made this statement. The dramatic progress being made in the field of molecular biology led us to investigate the relevance of this field of science to biological warfare. A small group of experts considered this matter and provided the following observations. All biological agents up to the present time are representative of natural occurring disease and are thus known by scientists throughout the world. They are easily available to qualified scientists for research either for the offensive or defensive purposes. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which would differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-calling organism. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological or therapeutic process upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. A research program to explore the feasibility of this could be completed in approximately 5 to 10 years at a total cost of $10 million. It would be very difficult to establish such a program. Molecular biology is a relatively new science. There are not many highly competitive scientists in this field. Almost all are in the university laboratories, and they are generally adequately supported from sources other than the Department of Defense. However, it is considered possible to initiate an adequate program through the National Research Council. The matter was discussed with the National Resource Council, and tentative plans were made to initiate the program. However, decreasing funds in the chemical and biological department, growing criticism of our efforts, and our reluctance to involve the National Academy of Sciences in such a controversial endeavor has led us to postpone this for the last 2 years. It is a highly controversial issue. And there are many who believe such research should not be undertaken, lest it lead to yet another method of massive killing of large populations. And, of course, if you'd like, of course, to get a copy of what I just read, it is available through Radio Liberty, or we do have the entire testimony, but there really are people out there who were intent upon creating a new disease for which there'd be no immune response. And I believe that they created it, and I believe it's called AIDS. Acquired immunodeficiency disease. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course I hope you've enjoyed the discussion this evening. Certainly when as I was talking to the people on the radio program, I pointed out, of course, that the blood tests were necessary, and would we, simply because occasionally you would get a false positive, doing a biopsy, would you stop doing all biopsies for cancer? Just because it's possible to get a false positive, a chest x-ray that gives you the wrong conclusion, would you stop doing chest x-rays? And of course, there is this organized effort to so confuse people they cannot see that we have a major epidemic. We are not trying to stop it. And in my estimation, there are people out there, I'm not saying everybody who says there is no AIDS epidemic is part of this CIA disinformation program, but I believe there is a CIA disinformation program out there, and I believe that, of course, the last thing they want is for the American people to realize that there is a population control agenda. We've already mentioned 1969, Donald MacArthur's testimony, Dr. MacArthur's testimony before the House Appropriations Committee. 2 months before that, of course, we have a four-tape set called The Do Order the Barbarian, and there Dr. Dunnigan talks about, and I believe it was in May of 69, hearing Dr. Richard Day, who was the medical director of Planned Parenthood, talking about the organization he was affiliated with. He called the order, and they were intent upon creating new diseases to kill off large numbers of people. They even talked about how, you know, in the future, why people would be using Japanese cars rather than American cars. They were going to have American cars poorly made and Japanese cars better made. And, of course, how they were going to encourage women in sports and how they were going to get abortion legalized. And remember, this is 1969, before Roe versus Wade. It's an amazing four-tape set. Well, we do know that in 1970, certainly Zygmunt Brzezinski is writing about the ability to create new diseases to incapacitate people. We do know that in 1972, the Club of Rome came forward with their book, Limits of Growth, talking about the necessity for population control. We do know that that same year, why the first Earth Summit was held with Maurice Strong in charge. And then, of course, it was 2 years later in 1974 when the National Security Study Memorandum 200 came out, which said the major thrust of American foreign policy should be population control throughout the world. And from that time on, that has been the major thrust of American foreign policy, and that is killing as many unborn and elderly people throughout the world as possible. But, of course, we could never let the people in the third world country know that was our true objective. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and, of course, I hope that many of you out there have enjoyed this program. I certainly want to point out that we are primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And certainly, If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know more about population control, we do carry a video called Population Control and a four-tape set on population control. And then, more recently, we made the video or DVD, Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction. And this will give you the best overview I know available today about what this is really all about. And then, of course, you have to understand that there really is a genocidal program. Ties into sustainable development. We have a four-tape set on sustainable development. We have a syllabus on sustainable development that contains a copy of the Earth Charter. And then, of course, the Earth Charter really is the new Mein Kampf for what's going on in the world, written by Marie Strong, by Mikhail Gorbachev, the former dictator of Russia. You wonder why he would be working with Marie Strong, a capitalist, but you see, communists and capitalists always work together. And then, of course, Stephen Rockefeller, the son of Nelson Rockefeller, the three of them wrote the Earth Charter, and you'll get a copy of that in our sustainable development material. And, of course, if you want to understand what's really happening, why we're not trying to stop the immigration influx into the United States, you have to understand there's a planned program to impoverish the American people. And in the Earth Charter, point 10A, they state there will be equitable distribution of wealth within nations, which is what communism's about, and within nations, which is, of course, what the new program, the Security and Prosperity Partnership that George Bush has agreed to last year with the President of Mexico and the President of Canada, where we are simply going to redistribute our wealth throughout the Western Hemisphere, at least the northern part of it, Mexico, the United States, and Canada, and raise the living standard of the average American to that of the Mexican peasant, and take away your protections of our Constitution, because we're moving away from it being a sovereign nation and merging into this one world system. And when you understand that, so much of what's going on really begins to make sense. And as our boys go overseas to fight and die in Iraq, this is a great distraction. They think they're fighting for freedom. We're not fighting for freedom. We're not fighting terrorism over there. We are, you know, losing our freedom here at home. And you have to understand that this whole Al-Qaeda movement was originally financed by the CIA, creating the best enemy money could buy. I wonder how many of you have read the letter by the president of Iran sent to President Bush. President Ahmadinejad of Iran asked the question, how is it possible that you could have had these terrorists planning, you know, an attack on the United States, and your intelligence agencies had knew nothing at all about it? How could your intelligence agencies have been so totally inadequate? And who has been punished in your intelligence agencies for their failure to know about the attack on the United States? I bet most of you have never read the complete text of that letter. Well, that's going to be our next Radio Liberty newsletter. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, if you'd like a copy. And pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Calling, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station we're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, right now we have us on the line, Andrew Skousen, and we're going to be talking about the latest articles in World Affairs Brief and bringing you up to date on what's really going on in the world. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about, of course, your view of what the most important issues are.
All right. Well, let's see if we can talk a little bit about the situation in Iraq, particularly the announcements made by President Bush in Iraq last week at the beginning of the week. Maybe we'll be able to talk a little bit about the economy and what's going on there as well.
All right. Go for it.
Well, while we've been examining the situation in Iraq here at the World Affairs Brief, we've noticed kind of a consistent trend that happens every time something significant occurs in Iraq, and that is that almost all of the news agencies here usually get their news sources from one source, and that is the U.S. government itself. And the government has all of these news agencies spinning and embellishing all of the reports that they send out. Take, for instance, the biggest case to hit, which is this targeted death of the Al-Qaeda leader Zarqawi, which, as I think most people know, has been trumpeted to the world as some enormous accomplishment of the U.S. Figuring out exactly where he was and then sending out a target strike force, which dropped two 500-pound bombs on a small house and killed Zarqawi. My father, who has been in military action and actually seen this size of bomb dropped, says that the size of a 500-pound bomb hitting a house where supposedly Zarqawi and company were meeting says that it's practically impossible for anybody to survive. The size of these bombs is so large that it will actually obliterate everything around, especially a small house, let alone two of these. And yet, if you watch the news articles about this, you will see Zarqawi being carried out on a stretcher, or the story tells about Zarqawi being carried out on a stretcher with scrapes and bruises, but generally intact and identifiable. So there's something that's not quite right with the story, and so obviously not quite right that it's surprising to us, even, that the media doesn't ask more cogent questions about this.
In fact, I remember, of course, the story was that when the American troops got there, well, the Iraqis were loading him into an Iraqi ambulance, and the American troops took him out of the ambulance and were trying to, give him CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, to save his life. And, of course, some of the local Iraqis said that the Americans killed him, but, of course, we're told that they didn't really kill him, that they've done an autopsy, and he died of the blast effect. Well, certainly you would expect that there wouldn't have been much left of him at all with not one but two 500-pound bombs there, but nobody seems to want to ask those questions. Are we really being told the truth about anything? And we'll be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Andrew.
Well, I think what's most interesting about what happened with the Zarqawi situation was was particularly how the media portrayed what happened before and after. Notably, of course, that that all of the information that they reported on came directly from the U.S. government as the sole source, which, of course, is not an unbiased source of information. But what played out following the attack was very interesting. Almost every day, the Pentagon would announce some new and kind of juicy piece of intelligence that was supposedly found in this obliterated house, which is, of course, a miracle that anything at all survived this kind of a huge bomb. And but what was more interesting even than that is that there were reports then that Al-Qaeda sent out internet announcements of its new intentions and a new leader to replace Zarqawi. Now, anyone who is at all savvy will see that that this isn't like a terrorist organization to admit that one of its leaders has been killed and then to announce its new leader and its new intentions with it. I mean, they stay underground, they keep all of their hierarchy secret. It just doesn't make sense, and this isn't typical of real terrorists. Here at the World Affairs Brief, we increasingly suspect that that Al-Qaeda is actually being scripted by some dark side of the government. Some operation within our own government is working both sides here to be able to create conflict and thus mold American opinions as well as change people's opinions about what the government should be allowed to do, thus creating situations where they will allow the government to assume greater and greater power, and thus we find ourselves with less and less of our rights.
And of course, we're told, of course, we got this terrible threat from Al-Qaeda here, and that's why we've got to give up all of our freedom, and yet there's not been one attack on the United States, in the last 5 years. Not only that, but of course our borders are wide open. The government's refused to close the borders, done everything they could to block our airline pilots from being armed, certainly has not done any of the logical things if there was really a threat of terrorism. And you have to ask yourself, why? We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
Well, Dr. Stan, I think that you brought up a very interesting point, which had me thinking for a while there, about why it is that the government doesn't allow at least some small-scale terrorist attacks here to occur. And I think that the reason why is that they don't want a great deal of incitement of the general population against our open border policy. If we had small terrorist groups that just started to engulf all of our country in flames, the cry would go out to seal off our borders, and by not allowing those things to occur by whatever means it takes, because obviously our borders are wide open and there are innumerable opportunities for small-scale terrorist attacks to occur and wreak all kinds of havoc, both in our major towns and in streets and roads and bridges and all over the place.
So they could just simply derail our trains, off in the middle of the desert. No way to find out who did it. A passenger
That's
train's
right.
going out. There's so many things that could be done here. There's way simply blowing up power poles, things of that sort, poisoning the water supply. A million things they could do if there was really an Al-Qaeda terrorist operation here in this country. And the question is, I believe, of course, there are some terrorists. I believe all of the terrorist organizations are thoroughly infiltrated by the FBI and by the CIA and by the NSA and DARPA and all of these very... We got 14 different intelligence agencies, ladies and gentlemen. And, when the communists were operating openly in America, the vast majority of members of the Communist Party were FBI informants who didn't know who one another were. And that's what we've done. In fact, we know that, for instance, the Irish Republican Army, that was such a threat to Great Britain, the number two man was a British intelligence agency. The chief murderer and torturer for the IRA was a British intelligence agent. The British intelligence had totally infiltrated the IRA. It was all a paper threat. Same thing happened in the Philippines, where the Philippine government organized Abu Sayyaf with a man named Edward Angeles. So should we be surprised that that they've infiltrated the Muslim terrorist movement in America? Go ahead.
I absolutely agree. I'd actually like to carry this topic, a separate story that is appearing in the Six World Affairs brief. But first, I'd like to finish a thought before, and that is, since small-scale terrorist attacks might actually benefit the idea of strengthening this arm of the U.S. government, which is Homeland Security, to give it all kinds of power and search and seizure rights, whatever they wanted, if small-scale terrorist attacks started to occur here. I think that the reason why that doesn't happen is they don't want to shut down the border. And I think that the public would cry out to shut down the border if small-scale terrorist attacks started to occur.
Good point.
But I mean, nobody actually knows exactly what their motives are or why they're holding back these terrorist groups. But as far as the idea that there are government agent provocateurs who are not only involved with all of the terrorist organizations and the organizations that U.S. security as that aren't merely trying to infiltrate these groups as informants, but actually trying to infiltrate them as agent provocateurs. And an instance of this has come to light recently. And this comes from reporter Jennifer Van Bergen, who writes for Rawstory.com. And she talks about different activist organizations in various major cities in the middle of the country. Let's see, in Des Moines, Philadelphia, Miami, Sacramento, apparently all across the nation. But this is what she writes. She says that there is a paid FBI confidential quote-unquote informant. However, activists say that this informant has tried to provoke conflict at various advocacy events and provoke violent incidents with police to get people arrested. This person is known by her alias, which is Anna. It says, although she is known among activist groups as either Anna Davies or Anna Davidson, others know her as Gry Damiani. She focuses her efforts largely on quote-unquote anarchist groups. In January 2006, Eric McDavid, Lauren Weiner, and Zachary Jensen were arrested in California and charged with knowingly conspiring to use fire or explosives to damage property. However, their attorney states that Annie was always pushing McDavid to do something criminal, that she taught the three how to make the bombs, supervised their activities, and repeatedly threatened to leave them if they didn't start to do something. Witnesses also say that Anna showed up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for an anti-AOS protest, which drew some 1,200 people, and showed up as if she was a medical attendant with a shirt with a red cross on it and a bag with the same logo, and several witnesses attested to trying to get help from her for heat stroke of some of the victims, and she always put them off as if she was busy. What she was doing, in fact, was, according to other protesters at the rally, was trying to organize sit-ins. A sit-in is where activists sit down and place themselves in front of a police barricade or on a roadway to try to stop traffic and provoke incidents with the police. The coalition that they have decided against sit-ins and had negotiated carefully with the police about routes and activities, and they had warned people individually not to participate. And consequently, most did not. But Road Papa from Fort Lauderdale saw this Anna person directing young people to sit down on the street directly in front of a line of police in riot gear. The fences penned the protesters in completely except where the riot police were, and this is where this person was directing people. In other words, she was trying to create a conflict to occur between these protesters and the police. So this is a small scale account of and a documentation of activists who are trying to stay within the law and notice this person who has been identified as an FBI agent, supposedly acting as an informant, who has actually been working hard to try to foment conflict and make these people see things that they normally can do.
And, of course, we saw that in what happened up in Lodi here in California, where you had, of course, this not very, very smart Muslim young man. And this older man came to him and was showing him all these horrible pictures to inflame his anger against America and to try to talk him into going to a terrorist training camp over in Pakistan. Whether he ever did it or not, we don't know, but he did go to Pakistan. But everything was done to get this young man to make inflammatory remarks. And it was the agent provocateur, paid by the FBI, who eventually got this boy, I don't know what he said, but eventually, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. His father was let off, but they were trying to get his father too. And it was the FBI informant who was encouraging this sort of thing. The same thing happened, with Rahman, Omar Rahman, who's in prison now. It was the FBI informant who was coming to him and suggested, let's blow up the Brooklyn Bridge, let's blow up the Harlem Tunnel and all of these things. And then Rahman obviously made some remarks that, he probably shouldn't have made, and they had him all recorded, and then they had him, and he'll never get out of prison. I have personally had people come to me and say, well, we're never going to get out of this without armed insurrection, are we? And I said, well, that's not our job. I mean, our job is to educate the American people. And these were CIA or some sort of intelligence people. They've done the same thing. The same fellow actually did the same thing to Joyce Riley on video film to try to get her to make inflammatory remarks. You never know in America who you can trust or who is a government agent trying to get you to incriminate yourself. And you may be the most patriotic of all individuals, or you may be a Muslim, or... but, of course, how can you have a free society when government is out there trying to entrap people into making inflammatory remarks?
That's exactly right. As far as that specific case of the Lodi, California, there's an instance of a former Bend, Oregon 7-Eleven clerk, a high school dropout, who was recruited by the FBI in 2001 to infiltrate the large Muslim community in Lodi, and he was paid an amazing $230,000 over 3 years to do so. He joined the group and taught terrorism to as many as he thought were willing, trying to provoke it. Apparently, one of those listings turned out to be the same Hamid, the same young man that they are claiming was the ringleader of this terrorist cell there, and. Anyway, is someone within the same group that suggested that this Pakistani and his father go back to Pakistan and attend a camp. But like you said, no one knows if the camp really is there or if they even attended it.
But we've got this one terrible terrorist, and his father drives a little ice cream cart, and this young man who really wasn't very smart is going to spend 30 years in prison. We're going to have to pay for it. But I thought Al-Qaeda was this terrible threat, They were going to just blow up all of our country, and that's why we're fighting. That's why we're fighting in Iraq, after all. Isn't it better to fight them in Iraq than fight them on the streets of New York? Or maybe they're precipitating most of these things here in the United States. And maybe most of what we think we know maybe not be true. We'll be right back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. We're talking about the terrorist threat in America. Go ahead, Andrew.
All right. Well, let's slightly steer here. I'd like to talk about the 3 points that early last week President Bush came up with and declared during his surprise visit to Iraq. This came during a time when supposedly he was going to speak to a group of reporters at Camp David on Tuesday. These reporters were bussed in and given a good dose of the standard official reports that they are always using in their news broadcasts. And most of them thought that they were going to meet with the president and key cabinet members and advisors. But it turned out that it was an elaborate ruse, that it was meant to mask the president's intent to secretly fly to Iraq Monday night for a surprise meeting with Iraq's Prime Minister Maliki on Tuesday. Maliki apparently wasn't even notified about the president's visit until 5 minutes prior. I can only imagine how reported must have felt after the false schedules about the Monday and Tuesday events were passed out to them. But let's examine what President Bush had in mind. He outlined 3 points, which he said he had planned for Iraq. Number one was more reconstruction policy changes. Number two, a new oil use policy, which supposedly dedicated a large share of petroleum for the benefit of the Iraqi people.
Why wasn't it always used for the benefit of the Iraqi people? Why would you have to have a new policy? I thought it was their oil.
Indeed. Excellent point. And number three was a new Baghdad military offensive to crack down on the insurgency, which was to begin the very next day. First of all, regarding the increased reconstruction, the reconstruction that has currently been going on, or better said, the lack of it, is an absolute disgrace to our country. Nothing has inflamed the good-hearted citizens that are there in Iraq than the fact that the situation in Iraq is continually deteriorating since the U.S. took over. The U.S. companies that have been called in to create this reconstruction have been neck deep in corruption and graft problems involving mostly no-bid contractors, people that have insider dealings with the people who grant the contracts in the government. And both the no-bid contractors and the Iraqi insiders who get money are the only people who seem to be benefiting from this supposed reconstruction. And all of the money that the U.S. taxpayers here are pouring into Iraq is just going to line the pockets of these contractors that are supposedly out.
And some of them, of course, are Halliburton, for which Dick Cheney has been getting a deferred salary. I don't know why he's getting a deferred salary. I thought he was the vice president, but at least for a time he got a deferred salary from Halliburton, which gets all these no-bid contracts. But anybody who thinks that there's any skullduggery there, obviously it must be paranoid. They must believe in black helicopters.
Indeed. Indeed. And
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and go ahead, Andrew. You were telling us about certainly the fact that we're spending billions and billions of dollars in Iraq on reconstruction, and it just never is getting done. We're supposed to be building medical clinics and schools and hospitals, and of course, about the only thing that gets accomplished is that some people are getting very rich, but these no-bid contracts that are going out are not helping the Iraqi people. And a lot of Iraqis, having been promised that we were going to rebuild the country, we were going to do all these wonderful things, and then we find out that the money's gone, nobody's responsible for it, nobody knows what happened to the money. Aw, shucks, isn't it a shame?
That's right, and the situation is increasingly deteriorating there. In fact, it has gotten to the point where even the sale of Iraqi oil proceeds is so controlled by the U.S. coalition there that the Iraqis themselves are blowing up the oil installations and impeding its flow out of their country. So this second point that that President Bush is trying to make with the new oil use policy, which supposedly is going to dedicate a quote-unquote larger share of petroleum for the benefit of the Iraqi people, is, I mean, who knows exactly what's going to happen with that. The oil pipeline and production facilities have been targeted by the insurgency precisely because the oil is being controlled entirely by the U.S.-led coalition and sold on the black market. And consequently, the insurgents would rather blow it up than leave it to the...
In other words, they feel the Americans are stealing their oil. They've always felt that America didn't come in to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They came in to steal the oil, and when they see the oil being stolen, then they, of course, are they just blowing up the pipelines.
That's right. And it's anyone's guess exactly where all of this oil is going. We don't seem to be seeing any benefit from it here at home with oil prices increasingly going up since the Iraqi war. That's a very dangerous point that President Bush brings up about that. Moving on to the third point, where he has announced a new offensive in the city of Baghdad, has the people of Baghdad scared to death, and they are probably rightly fearful about the indiscriminate attacks and through the use of aerial bombardment, which in previous cities has leveled whole neighborhoods, just as it did, for instance, in Fallujah and other so-called liberated cities. The whole situation in Iraq is increasingly unstable. Many of the people in Iraq describe the situation of what happens with the so-called Iraqi police force as basically death squads.
These are primarily Shia policemen who are going around killing Sunnis indiscriminately, and nothing's being done about it, and we're financing the whole thing. That's what's so incredible. We're financing the police force that's there killing the Sunnis indiscriminately, and then we wonder why some of the people don't trust us.
That's right. There's a report by Brian Conley and Issam Rashid from IPS. Reporters went down to the city morgue and talked to the people in charge, and they say that the Baghdad central morgue received more than 1,000 bodies each month this year, and a doctor has revealed that the killing in Baghdad increased after the occupation, and indeed it has flourished under the militia explosion and the creation of what Iraqis commonly refer to as death squads, which is what you just described. Most of the dead that are brought there by police have been tortured by beating, electricity, and other extremely horrible ways. This is from an Iraqi who refused to give his name. He says when an Iraqi is arrested by police, it most likely means that they will next see him dead in the streets of Baghdad. And in fact, the morgue is filling up. They don't even have enough room for all of the people that are dying right now. The situation gets worse and worse by the day, people say.
And of course, at least until recently, Basra, which is in the southern part, predominantly Shia, was fairly safe. And now, apparently, even the situation in Basra is beginning to collapse. So, you know, but we're being told here, we're winning the war, you can trust us, there's nothing to worry about. Just put your faith in us. We're going to stay there. We're going to stay the course until we win. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been there for 3 years. Things are a lot worse now than when, you know, immediately after the war, when Paul Bremer came over and disbanded the Iraqi military and disbanded the Iraqi police force and disbanded the Iraqi civil service and created the chaos we see today. Well, Andrew, pick the story up there.
All right. Well, I'd actually like to switch now to a topic that's a little bit closer to home. I'd like to briefly discuss the situation with the current economy, particularly the inflationary aspects of the economy. As most people know, the Federal Reserve has been gradually increasing the interest rates for the money that it loans out to banks and mortgage institutions, and this primarily occurs when there's a high degree of inflation in the economy. Now, inflation is the expansion of the money supply such that the money becomes devalued. This devaluation of the currency simply means that it takes more money to buy the same goods that you bought before, and it is tracked through the use of the CPI, which is the Consumer Price Index. Most of the information that I'll be referring to comes from Bloomberg. They say that U.S. consumer prices, excluding food and energy, rose more than forecast for a third consecutive month, increasing speculation that the Federal Reserve will keep raising interest rates beyond this month.
Now, there's Bloomberg. Is that Bloomberg Financial Services?
Correct.
All right. Yes. In fact, that's in Bloomberg, I think, is the mayor of New York, but this is his company. And so they're saying, of course, that inflation is really rising much more rapidly than we're being told.
That's right. And this is core inflation over the last 3 months, they say, was the highest since 1995, the rate of increase, that is. And this is excluding food and fuel. Now, in our opinion, the government tampers with the way that the numbers are used in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. It is a constant process of removing highly inflated prices from the so-called typical baskets of goods that Americans buy in order to manipulate the numbers downward. Their excuse for doing this is that they want to remove items that are outside of the standard realm. But in fact, you will notice that there is a great deal of number manipulation to put people more at ease with the amount of inflation that is actually going on this week.
And now our guest this evening is Dr. Ovanez Andrew Skousen. We're talking about, of course, what's really happened in the inflationary spiral. And Andrew has been saying that, according to Bloomberg Financial, the inflation rate has been really going up very, very rapidly in the last 3 months, far more rapidly than the government is telling you, and that inflation is not rising prices. It is basically too much money inflating, chasing too few goods, and the prices of goods are going up because all this money is out there and just bidding up the prices. So before we go on, though, Andrew, I'd like you to give your telephone number and or the website where people can get the World Affairs Brief.
Certainly, Dr. Stan. I think that the best way for people to find out about the World Affairs Brief is to log on to our website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And there they will find links to all of the stories that we and our researchers find throughout the Internet that we think are most important to supplement the standard daily news that we learn about each day. Most of them are in-depth articles about the most current stories that you normally don't hear about in the media, but which are accessible in the Internet at large. I think most people don't have the time to go searching through the hundreds of fairly decent news sources that there are out there in the Internet, so we try to provide that service for them, and they can log on to our website and find links to all of those. They can also find links to sign up for the World Affairs Brief, which is a summary of all of the news that is written by us here at the World Affairs Brief, principally by Joel Skousen, my father, and that entails a more in-depth analysis where we try to track what is actually going on and predict what is going to happen in the future. And if the people don't have access to the internet, they can also get they can also sign up for the World Affairs Brief and get a free copy of the print edition mailed to them by calling toll-free 1-877-518-5888. That's once again toll-free 877-518-5888.
All right, very good. Basically, you're saying that the consumer price index, they take the food out of it, they take the energy out, they take just about everything that's going up, because they don't want the American people to really know how bad the inflation rate is. Would that be a fair statement?
It is, and consequently, it warps the statistics, because the numbers that we are comparing in 2006 aren't the same as the numbers that we were looking at in 2005. For instance, in 2005, the Labor Department announced that they were changing the rates of various components, which have now become effective with the release of data for January 2006. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, which manages the numbers that come out of the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, are always changing the rates of the numbers. What happens is they not only take the straight increase in price of the goods, but they actually apply certain rates to certain factors that they think, in their opinion, are more important.
And then they want us to compare with what was before and what's now, only they've changed the definition of what's now. And it's sort of like what they did at Enron. It's simply lying to the public. And, of course, the old idea that figures don't lie, but liars figure, I think certainly applies to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They do not want the American people to realize that we are facing rapid inflation, intent upon which will ultimately result in the destruction of the value of everything they've worked their whole life for.
Precisely, which is why, in our opinion at the World Affairs Brief, we think that the rate of inflation is actually closer to half to once again as much as what the CPI is reporting, which is, I believe, around 4.5 to 5% increase. Now, that, to just kind of put it in perspective, means that the value of your, for instance, property would actually have to be increasing by 4.5 to 5%, just to keep up with inflation, if the CPI numbers were true, which, in our opinion, they are not. And so, in fact, values of things are going up probably by twice that amount.
And if instead of taking house prices, they take rent, and then they adjust the rent to whatever figure they want to. And they exclude food prices, and they exclude energy prices, and the price of oil. And the old adage is, are you going to believe what the government says? You're going to believe your lying eyes? And, well, if I were you, I would believe my lying eyes. So they're not really being forthright, and because they do not want the American people to realize what's really happening economically.
That's right. And very important, I think, is that not only is the rate of inflation still going up, but it is actually accelerating. Once again from Bloomberg, consumer prices in the first 5 months of the year were up at an annual rate of 5.2% estimated. We think, of course, that it's higher than that, compared with 3.6% increase at the same time last year. Energy prices, of course, rose 2.4% in May, after rising 3.9% a month earlier. And so, of course, gasoline prices are going through the roof. But the bottom line is that you can't necessarily just expect your money in the bank to continue to grow faster than the rate of inflation.
And that is really going to end up wiping out or impoverishing so many of our listeners.
Yes. precisely.
We've got a call. We've got a caller from Tennessee. Bob from Tennessee. Do you have a question for our guest, Bob? Bob, are you there? Well, I guess we don't have Bob anymore.
Yeah, it's Bob and me.
All right, go right ahead.
All right. Well, I'd like to bring up four major points that may explain why we believe the state of the economy is currently weakening and possibly in a more unstable situation. Profits are going up, but the wages and incomes of the average Americans are going down. However, most of the profits that we see are due to inflationary causes. So inflation is devaluing the dollar, causing people to have to raise their prices just to be able to survive in the market. So it appears that profits are going up, when in fact people are just trying to stay above water. The prices are being driven up by the minority of the people on the receiving end of their government's deficit spending, which of course includes all of the credit creation mortgage machines, which are driving much of the housing boom, and that will obviously, we believe, slow down as the housing market continues to flatten out. In fact, if you look at some of the major developments that places such Miami and Las Vegas, you will see great amounts of slowing down here. Projects, big housing projects, big condo projects are being canceled, and some of the early side of workers who are used to seeing huge projects continually come up from the major builders, AB and Pulte, are starting to see significant slowdowns in it. Some people, such as the graders for the grading site, have stopped receiving a major contract for even this year for some projects that were slated to end and now are being put on hold or canceled by some of the major developers here. So it's clear that many of the housing markets are starting to feel the slowdown of things. There is a much larger number of houses on the market being offered for sale than there are people that are buying them right now, which is, of course, going to affect the price of property, and we will probably see a decline in the value of properties here in the next week.
And, of course, the thing is that in the past, people were bidding up the prices because everybody had so much money and it was easy to borrow money and you could buy these houses with no money down. And some of the houses, you didn't even have to make any payments. You could just sort of forget your payments, and then the amount of money you owed on the house was getting larger every month. The negative interest, the negative loans, things of that sort. But, you know, this day is coming to end very, very soon because the money is beginning to get tighter and tighter, and I think we'll see as time goes by that the money is going to begin disappearing, and as that, the value of the houses go down, and the equity, their value on houses and on stocks and all of these things is going to disappear, and all of this artificial prosperity will soon, in my estimation, become simply a remembrance of things past. And people are going to have to get back to reality, and I think it's already started all over the world, don't you?
I do, and in fact, I think one of the most scary statistics that we have right now is that more and more people are getting deeper and deeper in debt. What people don't realize is that the amount of savings that people have is basically the cushion against recession that we have in the economy. If things go bad or things go sour, if there are enough people with deep savings to live off of and to work off of, the economy can sustain a fair amount of slowdown and shifting of jobs. jobs and things and still have enough capital in the right hands to be able to rearrange things and get things back together. When, however, there is a great amount of debt and everyone is extended beyond their means, if something happens with the economy, everyone starts to default. And when they default, the people that they default don't have their money either, and they have to default, and it's a domino effect backwards, resulting in extremely sharp depressions, often characterized by bubbles. And the indebtedness of U.S. households after adjusting for inflation has risen 42% in the last 5 years, almost once over in the last 5 years. The level of debt as a percent of after-tax income is the highest ever measured in our history right now. Mortgage and consumer debt is now 120% of after-tax income. I mean, people are spending 120% of what they make.
But, of course, they can't do that indefinitely.
That's
and, of
right.
course, what you're really describing is a scenario that will lead to deflation and the lowering of prices down the road when people just don't have the money for buying all of these things. They can't
exactly.
keep those indefinitely. You know, you can do this for a while, but eventually the day of reckoning is coming. And we have been living so well on borrowed money. But when the music stops and suddenly that money isn't there, an awful lot of people are playing this game of financial musical chairs. They're going to find themselves standing there, and there are no chairs to get into. The banks come and take everything they have, their home, their business, their car. It's happened over and over again, and I fear it's going to happen again very soon.
It's true. In fact, the rate of personal savings for the first time in the history since the Depression is in the negative numbers. People are actually removing money from their savings now. And part of this, of course, is that people see that the money supply is being inflated, and so they are trying to spend things on things that won't become devalued, such as properties. And with mortgage rates pushed down to a really low rate, that encourages people to borrow, and they all borrow from the Federal Reserve, well, indirectly, at least. And as the Federal Reserve starts to tighten their belt, less and less money becomes available for people, and people start to see the reality of the situation with money. I think it's important that people realize that the free market economy itself is actually fairly stable. When we have to cut back, that's what creates these cycles of boom and bust that many economists attribute to so-called natural cycles of the economy. But in fact, if the free market is left to its own ends, it ends up creating more products to chase less and less dollars, thus increasing the value of the money that is there, and thus resulting in substantial deflation over time. If the free market were left to its own ends, you would be able to put your savings away in the bank, and even if the bank didn't offer you a huge return, you would find those dollars constantly being able to buy more and more with their buying power. So I think it's important that people realize that the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates is actually a bad thing for the economy, and recession is kind of the way that the market puts things back into check and says, okay, well, we don't really have all of this money to work with. People have to scale back their improper expenses, their improper investments and things, and focus on more solid construction and more solid investments. When interest rates are pushed down extremely low and money is flowing more freely, all kinds of harebrained schemes get financed, and there's a lot less checks and balances that are normally naturally in place by the free market.
And I think that we're in real trouble. We find now that the Fed is gradually raising the interest rates to try to control rampant inflation. They're not telling you that during the first 3 months of this last year, the overall debt of the United States, federal, state, local, and personal, and car, and home, increased $1 trillion. Unparalleled in all history, that's $1 trillion. If you'd like to see the figures, we have them. You have to understand that we're on the edge of a financial precipice. If you have not yet seen our video or VHS on the financial tsunami or read our syllabus, you need to get it. You need to understand what's going on. And we'll be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen to wrap up this evening's program. Well, Andrew, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
All right, well, let me just make a quick point then about gold and silver while we're on the topic. Gold and silver have experienced a fairly strong rally in the past month, rising to above $600 an ounce. By our analysis, prices were actually beat back down to the mid-500 levels in the past 2 weeks by larger institutional traders and central banks, who began selling large amounts of gold. It's interesting to note that central bank sales or loans of gold is one of the key tactics that the establishment system uses to keep the price of precious metals low. Normally, with high inflation, such as we are seeing with the economy right now, you would see solid materials or non-inflationary materials such as gold and silver start to rise in value quite rapidly, and you would be able to more easily track the actual rate of inflation based on the comparison of all of this paper money with the actual solid gold and silver values of the market. But since almost all of the gold and silver reserves are controlled by the establishment system through the central bank, many of the effects are not seen. For instance, only a portion of gold and silver transactions are actually made public. Major players work within private channels to sell things, and then they buy it back privately. Thus, it looks like lots of gold is being sold, and consequently, the price tends to go down, whereas, in fact, a great deal of it is being bought up privately without it being seen by the market. So gold is not necessarily as bad of an investment as it may seem, and as people search for ways out of the high inflation of dollars, more and more people will start searching for something solid like gold to invest in. As far as what people should privately own in gold reserves, it is our opinion here that if difficult times were to come, it would be hard for gold to be actually used as currency and as a means of exchange, because people are so unfamiliar with what the actual price of gold is, that it would be difficult for it to become a good bartering item.
All right, fine. This is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Andrew Skousen. And are you suggesting that gold would not be a good thing to hold or not?
It is okay in limited quantities. I don't recommend that people buy solely gold. It's best to buy a great deal of product that will quickly go scarce in the economy, such as generators, etc.
All right, fine. Well, I thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we'll look forward to having you on again.
Thank you, Dr. Good
night. God bless. Bye-bye. All right, well, that was Andrew Skousen, and hope you enjoyed our conversation here about what's really going on. And I think we covered some very, very important issues, especially what's going on over in Iraq. And then I think the monetary issues, and as we face these, are very serious consequences for America. Now, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. It's 5 hours a day. We reach out on shortwave and internet and satellite and radio somewhere in America, trying to get people educated what's going on. So if you're interested in satellite, you can get on the Telstar 5. You can hear our programs with Joyce Riley and I and two others are on 24 hours a day. My programs are there 9 hours a day. Joyce is on 9 hours a day, and we know people are listening because lightning struck the transmitter the other day, and a fellow does the uplink and a fellow sells the satellites got over 125 calls within half an hour demanding to know why the satellite was off the air. So we are getting a larger listening audience, a great way to get us. Of course, you can hear us on shortwave, you can hear us on the internet, and then, of course, we hope you'll tell others about our programs. If you really want to understand what's behind everything going on, you have to understand the spiritual forces, and that is covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, or the TV or video that goes with that. If you want to understand what's happening financially, our syllabus and or DVD and or VHS, the financial tsunami. To understand why we're in Iraq and the source of all of the wars of the last century and where this is all going. Iraq, the untold story, it comes with a syllabus, or you can get it by itself, but the talk, I think, is classic. If you want to understand the background of funding communism, why we did not win in Vietnam, you need to get my talk. My interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. That's The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. For an analysis, 911, of course, it's our Prophecy Club talk, 911 Contrived. That's 911 Contrived, available both in video and in VHS. To understand the mass genocidal program that's being carried out, why we're not trying to stop the AIDS epidemic, why we outlawed DDT and 100 million people died? 100 million people died. Why we have 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease? Our talk, planned population reduction. Planned population reduction. You'll learn about statin drugs and their impact upon male virility and upon reproduction. So much you need to know. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.